Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag, Thung, Earthlets, and welcome to another edition of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am Molchar, the publicity droid for 2000 AD, and what a packed week we have for you this week. I hope you enjoyed the supplementals over the past couple of weeks, which is something a little bit different, a little bit special. In this week's Thrillcast, we have a trio of very special guests. Firstly, we're going to be talking to Gordon Rennie, writer on the series Aquila, which is our current US format series out both in the UK and North America. And then we have two very special guests later on who, well, you'll find out if you keep listening. Now, every week 2000 AD publishes so much stuff, sometimes it's hard to catch up. So let's look ahead at what we've got coming up for you today. What's available from comic book stores and newsagents today? Well, of course, there's 2000 AD Prog 1930, which has some amazing strips in it. I mean, you've got Judge Dredd Breaking Bud, which is more political satire from John Wagner and Richard Elson. You've got Terror Tales Phase Shift by C.B. Harvey and David Hitchcock. This is a one-off story, self-contained, usual kind of future shock format. Now, David has done The Visible Man for our specials before. He's a wonderful horror, a black-and-white horror artist with a great sense of atmosphere. Already well known for his award-winning Spring Hill Jack book, so he's really one to watch, and it's great to see him in 2008. He's bringing a little bit of horror. You've also got Slain Primordial, which is Simon Davis doing something even more different than what he's been doing before with the art on there. And you've got Grey Area Locked In. We're hoping to have Dan Abnett on the future Thrillcast about this and his other work for 2080. And also Strontium Dog, The Sticks Fix, which is John Wagner and Carl Sesquera taking Johnny Alpha back to doing what he does best, which is tracking down criminals. So that's 2080 Prog 1930, which is out in all good newsagents now, as well as digitally from 2080 and our Android and Apple apps. Also today, we have Judge Dredd, the Mega Collection number 9, which is Devlin War by John Smith, Sean Phillips and Colin McNeil. Now, this is available through newsagents in the UK and Ireland only, but it's another of these beautiful hardback editions collecting the stories of Devlin War. How do you describe Devlin War? He is a flamboyant exorcist for Vatican City in Judge Dredd World, who is asked to go and deal with a vampire outbreak in an underwater prison in the Caribbean, which is called Aquatraz. Let's just let that sink in for a moment. Aquatraz. It's just brilliant. But coming up in a week's time, we've got another couple of things. As well as 1931, we've also got Judge Dredd Magazine 360, which is where all the stories that are running at the moment wrap up in a wonderful smorgasbord of conclusions. Then you've got Al Ewing's extraordinary story, The Cop, which comes to a close, as does the latest Judge Anderson story, which we discussed with Emma Beebe in our first supplemental episodes last week and the week before. So do check that out. And Pat Mills and Clint Langley's American Reaper reaches its final episode. We've also got interviews with Andrew Curry, the artist on Judge Anderson, a one-off return of Tales of the Black Museum, with some great artwork by Paul Davidson, and the bagged floppy edition which you get with every issue, even if you purchase it digitally, is Interceptor by Ian Edgington and Steve Pugh. This is going to be the last magazine before the official jumping on issue for the Judge Dredd magazine, which is issue number 361, which is out in June. So we're going to be talking more about that in a future edition of the Thrillcast. Also out next Wednesday, we have Aquila number 2, which is coincidentally why we're talking to Gordon Rennie on this week's edition. But before then, We've been asking you to send in not just your feedback, but also your recollections of your very first issue of 2000 AD. I've got mine. I'm sure everyone else remembers the first time they were exposed to Thrill Power. And thank you to the people who've fed back via our email, which is thrillcast, all one word, at 2000adonline.com, and through Twitter. Thank you especially to Fox. He doesn't give his full name, but he does sign off as a long-time fan who remembers his first 2000 AD as being Prog 757, which I remember very well back in the early 90s. Fantastic Kev Walker ABC Warriors cover showing Hammerstein getting obliterated. He says, from memory, I was off school with mumps and had just come back from the doctors and saw 2000 AD on the shelf. Had Hammerstein on the front cover. Was intrigued, bugged my mum for ages to ask if I could get it. Been hooked ever since. Funnily enough, it wasn't Dread that got me interested, it was ABC Warriors. Still a favourite of mine to this day. Luckily, the newsagent at the time would keep runs of this and older issues, so I managed to get all of them back to Prog 750 so I could get the whole ABC Warriors. These Chronicles of Chaos story. So thank you very much indeed for telling us about your first prog, Fox. If you've got your own particular memories about your first issue of 2000 AD, please do send them in and we'll read out the best on air. Also, Gareth Hopkins, thank you very much for your feedback, Gareth. He wants to know why were the last two Thrill Casts called Supplementals? Well, the idea is that as the structure of the Thrill Quest is changing, because, you know, we're experimenting, we're seeing what works, we're seeing what doesn't, we decided it was a good idea to have in-depth chats with particular artists and writers. And the idea of the supplemental is that we clearly mark what those are, so you know that this is going to be a one or two part in-depth analysis and chat. And we're just planning the next one, looking ahead, which I think should be of particular interest to Fox and any other fans of the ABC Warriors. Now, Gareth actually asks, he says, I'm kind of in love with everything John Smith's written, even the not very good stuff. So a focus on his work would be really welcome. That's a really good idea. We'd love to be able to focus on John Smith's work, one of the great 2000 AD writers who I don't think gets enough press, really. His stuff is incredibly inventive. Things like Indigo Prime, things like Tyranny Rex, Devil in War. You know, that's all fantastic stuff. So, rest assured, we will be contacting John to see if we can get him onto the Thrillcast. Now, as mentioned earlier, next week sees the publication of issue number 2 of Aquila, which is our latest US format comic. It's going to be available from all good newsagents and comic book stores, both in the UK and in North America. Now, Aquila is a wonderful sword and sorcery series set in Roman times. And the other day, we got Gordon Rennie, the writer, on the line from Scotland to talk about this, this amazing series, which is getting its debut for American audiences. And we're now going to talk to Gordon about the strip. He's on the phone all the way from Scotland. Welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast, Gordon.
Hey, Michael. Hey.
So the first issue of Aquila has been out for a couple of weeks in US format. Do you want to tell us a bit about the strip and how it came to be?
Well, I've always been... I just love Romans and history in general. A former star is going to accuse me of being far more interested in the past and the future, right, which is actually true. I can't deny that. I've never really liked science fiction that much, weirdly. I always wanted to do something with Romans in it and the supernatural. I think 2000 needed another fantasy strip. Mm-hmm. I think Black Hawk was a template, but when you're so far off it, you have to squint really, really hard to see that the Black Hawk's still in there.
Yeah, well, that was the old classic strip about the Roman gladiator transported to an alien world, space, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's beamed up to fight alien gladiator battles in space. and then they didn't know what to do with that character because they pushed him to a black hole in the fantasy world.
Right.
When he loses his soul, he gets his soul sucked out of him just like Aquila, so that's where that comes from.
Right.
He's an African slave who's made to fight alien gladiators. And then he disappeared and then never came back.
Yeah.
And then he had a cliffhanger that was never resolved.
And I mean, for those who haven't read Aquila, and people really should pick it up because it's great. The central premise is that this was one of Spartacus's one of the revolting slaves who was crucified on the Appian Way.
Yep.
And surrendered his soul to a dark goddess from
Egyptian demon called Arethusa, which is from Egyptian mythology. Mm. She consumed the souls of the hearts of the wicked after death. You get your heart weighed, and if your sins outweigh your virtues, she devours your heart.
And so that, I mean,
that's a lovely story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a kind of relatively straightforward horror fantasy idea. What gave you the idea to weave this kind of historical narrative through it all? Because he's essentially immortal. So with the first issue, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody about where it goes, but in the first issue, someone is recounting seeing him at the Roman invasion of Britain. So where did you get the idea to kind of weave all these different historical events into it?
Well, there's so much like cool stuff in Roman history, I didn't know where to start, so I decided to have all of it in there.
Right.
And that's basically to make a character that walks through time and experiences all these events that take place over centuries. So you have to be immortal or nearly indestructible in order to accomplish that. And I wanted to base it really in a historical reality. I didn't want to do an out and out fantasy strip. I say an artist friend of mine wanted to work on this originally and saw it being Clash of the Titans, a sort of romp fight big monsters, and I went, no, it's going to be gritty and horrible and dark and grimy and with loads and loads of real history in it to make it feel real. I had a strong sense straight from the start that what the feel of it was going to be, and once you got that in a story, I think you know you're on a winner. Quite often, once you know what the world is and how it feels, what's right and what isn't right for it.
Well, there's that wonderful quote in the first issue where the guy says, I saw you then, my first Roman, and everything that I had imagined them to be, terrifying, unstoppable, the way of things to come. I think that's probably the best summation of 1,000 years of Roman history I've ever read.
When the Romans turned up in Britain, the British were a bunch of hicks. They thought it was hilarious that the Britons rode chariots,
right,
which had been out of fashion about 500 years earlier in the continent.
So let's talk about the art, which I think brings so much to the strip. Lee Gallagher's work on that is just stunning. I mean, how do you two work together on something as detailed as this?
I make him redraw things, which he hates. That's probably why he's off. I made him redraw all the shields in the prologue story because they're the wrong shape.
Wow.
Because he drew Imperial era shields and it's a Republican era in that story. And I went, no! I didn't tell him the arm was wrong. I didn't have the heart to tell him the arm was wrong as well. He made me draw that. It's only history more like me that knows these things, but I think it matters.
So you've clearly put a lot of thought and effort into the strip.
I hope so, yeah.
Is that part of the allure of looking to the past, is kind of digging through all that back matter, as it were?
Yes, it's just kind of getting it right, or what matters and what doesn't matter. I mean, clearly, since you've got Egyptian demons and indestructible immortals in it, that's not real. So, but then I think you've got to get the small details real instead to get it right, to make it feel like it's actually happening in a real world.
So sort of getting that balance means that the fantasy is almost made real because you have the little details correct.
Yes, hopefully. Yeah, that's what you go for.
Yeah. And you're clearly having a lot of fun with this series. Is there anything you really wanted to include but thought, nah, people are never going to go for that. They're never going to believe that.
No, not so far. No, I think I've started off in historical reality with the invasion of Britain, and later on the fall of Nero and the rise of Christianity, or the beginnings of Christianity anyway, in Rome. But, well, where it goes, this, the next arc is really kind of off the planet.
Right.
Or under the planet, rather.
Okay.
But, so I wanted to establish reality first before we get into the outright fantasy parts. But then I'll veer back into reality again after that.
Oh, right, okay.
But I can't think of it.
That's an interesting direction to take it in. When you say, you know, you've established it within such a strong real setting.
Yes, to have them meet historical or pseudo historical figures, like the Emperor Nero, Saint Paul, people like that, Queen Boudicca, people like that, and then what's coming next is much more mythological.
Right. Okay. And obviously, this has been chosen as one of the strips to be repackaged into American comic book format. It seems to work just as well in sort of 30-page chunks as it did in 2080. How do you get the balance between writing that kind of weekly episodic format and creating a fulfilling narrative?
Well, I generally think in 5-page episodes. I dislike it when you read stories that are clearly written for a collection and don't seem to satisfy in weekly episodes. I think a 5-page story in the prog should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Which is why I sometimes sweat blood into these things for each individual episode. It feels like it anyway sometimes. So I generally think about the weekly episodes. It's gratifying that this has been collected in the American format. I've not actually seen it yet. Apparently my copies are on the way.
They are on the way, yes.
Oh, you know, I saw a PDF. What we're talking about. So I'm glad it clicked well. It wasn't conceived to run as a 150-page, you know, story. About that, I can't remember.
And this kind of, I mean, let me rephrase that question. With this strip, it's been running for a few series now. Do you have an end in sight? Is there an end to the story of Aquila?
There should be an end. Yes. I don't like it when stories go on and on forever. I don't want to be one of these guys that's still writing the same story 30 years later. That's kind of appalling to me. I think stories should end. I mean, Aquila does have an end. So does Absalom.
Right.
So does Jaeger. They have finite ends. I always admired what Robbie Morrison did with Nikolai Dante.
Yeah.
The template for what we should do. Everyone should be doing 2080, really. Right. This giant epic that has a definite ending. So Aquila doesn't end. I don't quite know where or when it is yet, but it will end. Because he has a goal. And if a character's got a goal, then, he should reach that goal at some point. I mean, Judge Dredd doesn't have a goal, just do your duty. So that can go on forever. I think it's Sean Chim Dog or something. But once you give a character a goal, they have an aim. So, I mean, my characters do seem to have goals, like Absalom does, rescues grandkids, and Aquila's getting his soul back. So once you do that, the character has to reach that point, in which case your story is over.
Yeah.
You have to call it quits there. You know, and find something else to pay the mortgage.
Yeah. Well, that's all we've got time for. Thanks very much, Gordon, for chatting to us.
Okay, see you later then.
Now, that will be familiar to anyone who was listening to BBC Radio 1 in the mid-90s, the adaptation of classic Judge Dredd stories in little 3-minute bites that appeared over the course of several weeks on the pop music station. God, I'm really showing my age there. This was an adaptation by producer Dirk Maggs, and we were very privileged the other day to get both Dirk and also comedian and actor and writer Johnny Vegas into the Nerve Centre sound booth to talk a little bit about their love of 2000 AD. We don't get many visitors to the 2080 Nerve Centre. Metquake tends to keep the people away, but it's my pleasure and a privilege to welcome two very special guests to the Nerve Centre today. Big 2000 AD fans, Mr. Johnny Vegas and Mr. Dirk Maggs, welcome to the Thrillcast, gentlemen.
Hey. Like, that's great.
Thank you for having us.
My absolute pleasure. It's great to see you. We thought we'd get you in because you are 2080 fans of note, and just want to really chat to you about what 2080 means, because Johnny, you've started getting back into it recently, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I've rediscovered this. It was quite the obsession when I was younger,
yeah.
And you know, when you suddenly later in life, my son has discovered comics, and it's great. It's sort of it's drawn me back in, and reading all the. Going back now with all these issues available, you know what I mean? The Judge Dredd books, being able to read about that, you're going, I was saying earlier, it's brilliant that I can remember, it feels like I'm sat in my room as a 9-year-old. It's fantastic going
but
back to it. And
it's
going,
curly whirly.
Yeah, but even yeah, I can't revisit them. I'm about to jack in the chocolate now.
Yes. What's it like seeing your son discover these stories that you have such sort of nostalgic feelings for?
It's great. I mean, he's discovering his own things within. You know what I mean? I don't want to do the thing of forcing 2000 AD in him. It's that you know, I got into it because my brothers had it and it was there and I read it, and I think you can push too hard to sort of, you know, go, this was mine. One day, all this will be yours. I failed miserably on Star Wars, so I'm not going to mess it up with 2000 AD. There's a room upstairs that was meant to be his room, his inheritance. But it's great because I see a lot of traits in him, the same as myself, that have been more creative than academic. And I think through something like this, I genuinely think 2000 AD ultimately got me onto my A-level art course, because it was through reading 2000 AD that I started to draw and doodle, and a lot of that was sci-fi inspired.
Yeah.
Which one day eventually, when I was talked out of doing art at O-level by my parents, you know, it's that thing, you're going to do something practical, which was technical drawing, and like a year later computers came and they replaced everyone. But when I went for my A-level, my dad said, you know what, he draws all the time.
Yeah.
And it was as a direct sort of influence of reading.
Brilliant.
2000 AD. And what I loved at the time was that there was no dumbing down within it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
These felt, I mean, maybe as I got older, you learnt to read between the lines of the, you know what I mean, these sociological messages within there, but you just go in, it felt like a grown-up comic and stories that I was privy to, that stuff that I wouldn't get on the TV.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a lot more hard-hitting.
Yeah, I mean, did you ever get any resistance from your parents to reading this slightly nasty, vicious little comic?
No, not at all. As I say, most of my cultural influence was stuff that came into the house through older brothers.
Right.
So it was that thing of the cooler older brother had it, and then when you read it, I don't think they ever sort of realised it was. I don't think they ever picked it up and read it. I don't think we weren't policed in the same way in those days.
No,
you know what I mean? There was no internet, and there was no. I think they'd just see a comic and think it's a comic along the lines of you being, or and the, you know, if only they knew.
Yeah.
I think Dredd kneeling down in the cursed earth. My dad probably thought it was a religious magazine. Oh, look, he's praying.
Some of not lost after all.
Some of the stuff you get in, like, Nemesis the Warlock. You know, I had a religious upbringing, and I think, God, I'm really glad that my parents didn't actually pick up one of, you know, because I picked up most of the classics from 2080 monthly, so when they were first reprinted.
Yes, yeah.
And going through, like, Pat Mills' stuff, I'm like, God, I'm glad they didn't see me reading this, because I'd be in such trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, although I went to seminary school, so I was like, this isn't that far off the mark.
Theologically.
I thought this was more a social documentary. my time training for the priesthood.
Brilliant.
Kept going off in the grandstand to tame myself a ship. Didn't happen.
So Dirk, what about you? What was your first exposure to film?
Well, I came to it late, really, because when they started up, I was already like
I kind of, I'm a bit older than Johnny, and so I was like out, you know, chasing girls, playing in bands, all that sort of stuff, you know. And kind of comic books wasn't, you know, I'd kind of moved beyond them, because I was raised in the days of the sort of silver age of Superman and, and DC and Marvel. Mm. And 2000 AD came in just about the time I was, you know, getting out and playing in bands. So I kind of missed it all. And then in the mid 80s, when I was in the BBC, I proposed to the BBC a programme about Superman's 50th birthday. Mm. And part of that was putting on a trial of Superman, and we had Lois Lane defending and Lex Luthor prosecuting, and it was a fun idea. And I wanted to get witnesses for the prosecution and for the defence. Mm. And among the witnesses for the defence was Dave Gibbons.
Oh right, yeah.
Who I'd read Dark Knight Returns. I was just getting back into graphic novels. Read Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
And read Watchmen. I just thought Dave and Alan's work was fantastic. Mm. And I hadn't really looked back at what they'd done. But when Dave came in and we chatted, and we're still mates now, because we kind of, you know, we're ladies of a certain age. you know, we kind of like, we totally hit it off. And the sense of humour and all of this stuff. And he said, oh, you should go back and read some of the old stuff. So I did. And I went back and I read through. And I was, what is this? I had no idea. It was, you know, you guys, you know, with the curly whirly and the tizer. And I'm like, you know, on the train up to London with the commuters, reading, you know, about the cursed earth and whatever else, you know. And I'm like, this is fantastic stuff. And what I loved about it, it wasn't just the vision of the thing, or the artwork, and all the ideas. It was the sense of humour. It was the pulling the rug irony thing. It was taking the Mickey out of, you know, United States. Sort of, there was always a bit of a poke in the ribs at DC and Marvel in 2008. Yeah, I just loved it. And it took a while, because when I did start making programs, it was Batman and Superman. Mm. But when the chance to do Dread came along in 95, I just couldn't turn it down. It was too good. Although I didn't write it, Paul Powell wrote it. It was, you know, still a treat just to be in the studio making it happen.
Oh, yeah, we talked before we started recording about, I remember quite vividly sitting listening to Radio 1, and you'd get the little burst of Judge Dredd in the middle of the day. That was quite an unusual way of presenting it. How did you convince Radio 1 to go for something like that?
No, I didn't want to do it that way at all.
Oh, really?
No, we were doing this thing. We started with Batman. Hmm. 3 minutes. They had a meeting where I was in Radio Light Entertainment, which also did sort of light drama.
Yeah.
Cut a long story short, Matthew Bannister took over Radio 1, wanted to make his own mark. Throw out all the old DJs who've all since been arrested. No, sorry, not true at all. Throw out all the old DJs. And wanted to do a daily drama. Mm. And they asked us all in, it's a big meeting, all the producers, and has anybody got an idea for a daily drama? Well, I just assumed that they would want some sort of social awareness, you know, drug users on a council estate type of stuff, you know, being trendy. Mm. So I just sat at the back and shut up. But I had already had the idea of doing more superhero stuff, because I've been doing it on the other networks. And somebody put the drug abuse on the council estate up. No, this up, that up. So in the end, I thought, well, okay. I just, because no one else was saying anything, I said, how about Batman?
Yeah.
They said, yes. And that was it. Right. And I thought, oh, God, I made it. And then he said, but can you do it in 3-minute episodes? And, you know, there's that moment where you sort of say yes to something, thinking, oh, my God. And so I sort of said yes and put a smile on my face. And the meeting broke up shortly after. So then I just went to my room and panicked. Like, how do we do this? But then I had, to talk about technically doing it for anything, for Dread or Batman or any of this material. I mean, the two things about it is that, radio is an ideal complement to it, because it actually, the pictures stay the same as they've always been in your head. You're just adding the soundtrack.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, when you know, you said 3 minutes a day, and I panicked, but actually I thought about it. And if you look at the comic book page, the panels start, the panels pick up from the previous page or the previous month or whatever it is. And at the end of that, just that one page, they have to provide you with something that makes you want to turn the page over.
Mm.
So basically, there's always a little cliffhanger, even if it's What's that? You know, it could be anything. And so I thought, well, that's it. Each 3-minute episode is a page of a comic book. Mm. Not literally, but it's equivalent to it in sound terms, which is you fall on your feet, you kind of start running. You can hit any backstory you need, you do while you're moving the story forward. You don't ever have two people sit down and chat. You know, you always keep the story moving forward. You have one major story evolution in the middle, and you finish on some kind of cliffhanger. And that sounds silly, and it sounds formulaic, and it is formulaic. But actually, when you tell a whole story in 3-minute episodes and sort of stitch it all together, that gives you quite a nice sort of flow of energy through the thing. And you can play longer themes out as well. So without getting too technical, which I think I am, it became actually an ideal way to tell the story.
But can I ask him? Sorry.
Yeah, no, you
can
carry on.
No, because I'm fascinated. I'm sure it's something, you know, that anybody who has anything to do with adapting things, that characters that people hold so precious, was how pressured did you feel casting the voice of Dread? You know what I mean? The reaction from the hardcore faithful.
At that time, the budget was so tiny. I had to go. We had 5 actors do the whole of Mega City One.
Wow.
5 actors for all the judges, all the villains, everything. So I just cast the most versatile people I know. And the bloke I cast as Dread is Gary Martin, who actually was the voice of the honey monster in the Sugar. And he's got a fact. Gary's got this amazing voice. He'd just come off being the rock chewer in Never Ending Story 2. But you know, the thing is, I know Gary's a great bloke. He loves 2018, and he's got this great voice.
Yeah,
you know that he does, and he can do the voice without straining himself. Because you know, over 63-minute episodes, 2 series of 63. You know, you can't have an actor's going to
please tell me you've got some lost footage. Oh, do you know what I mean? Where he's wandered in the voiceover.
I
am the Lord. Tell him about the honeymoon.
Yes,
come on, there's got to be some outtakes.
There are outtakes. But the thing I do remember, we were doing Judge Cal, the whole Judge Cal story. And Gary and Bill DeFreeze, who played Spider-Man when we did Spider-Man. Right. Yeah, I was always going for the, because I needed versatile actors.
Yeah.
Billy was actually an American. He was great, great voice, that talent, and a fine actor, a lovely guy. He's now in Maine, USA, doing stuff. He and Gary were on mic, and they kept barging each other. It got really physical. Sorry, I'm sniffing. And when the take is over, Bill actually said, he's beaten me up. And they were really having an argument. So it kind of actually, Dredd and Cal actually had a bit of a thing going.
Right, oh, brilliant.
But that was what I loved. You know, again, it was the sense of humour. It was Judge Fish and all of that stuff.
Mm.
And you, it's so stupid. And you're like, okay, so what effect for Judge Fish? So, okay, a bowl of water blowing bubbles in it. Yeah, what do you think, Judge Fish? Blah, 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 blah. And it lends itself. But the thing about Dread is it has got this sort of, it's got this huge themes. It's sort of, it's got this American kind of size to it and sensibility to it. And you get this kind of English sense of humour, which very much lends itself to radio, which really is a stupid idea of making a fish a judge. Or the thing where Cal makes the judges dress up as little girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly you have to talk like this. It's just, and you can do this stuff. And that's what's fantastic about 2000 AD. And Marvel and DC never quite had that irreverent sense of humour, because it was the little street fighter coming in and making, you know, getting a little corner for itself. So it's that kind of enthused me hugely, and I've missed it ever since. I was hugely jealous when Big Finish started doing Judge Dredd. So I was very cross. Thank good I was doing Russ Abbott at the time. I don't know what I would have done otherwise.
And that's it, when you get talented people in like that, you know, that can do that many voices.
Yeah,
because I love
it. It just brings home to me the lack of range I have.
No, not
one voice.
Well, no, you've got 2 voices, because earlier on you were doing an impression of yourself.
Yeah, come on. Well,
that's me when they go, come on, say monkey. Yeah. I say, I do when I go, monkey, and they go, no, do it properly. And you go, monkey. And they go, yay! You and know, then I just collapse in a heap on the floor crying, going, I've done other things.
But the thing about it is, it's that happy combination of people who are well known and fit right in, and then you've got these wonderful people who lend themselves to everything. Mike Roberts, who played Walter the Wobot in it, was actually, I got him from playing Groucho Marx in our Marx Brothers shows, our Flywheel Shines for Flywheel, and he's just a great ad libber. Yeah. One of the best ad libbers he did on the Marx Brothers show. They did a scene where they fall into a pigsty, and all the rest of the cast came in going like this, and he's quick as a flash, he turned to the audience and said, look at this, two nice Jewish boys surrounded by ham. And it was it went to, and afterwards I said to him, what a great gag. And he said, what gag? I said, the ham gag.
Yeah.
He said, was there? And he blanked it. He was so of the moment. Right. And so I got him to do Walter, and he gets so many great ad-libs. And of course, it's right, you know, you never leave anything in that would cut across, but it was great. Mm. Anyway.
It's weird, you know what? It's weird, Walter, because he's probably one of the very few characters that I sort of didn't
put your teeth on.
I wasn't a huge fan of that.
He never really won me over, because it almost felt like that, you know, whenever you get an animation, they've got to have the sidekick, the comedy element.
Yes,
that's where you go. It never felt like it.
He was a bit more overt comedy than because I always prefer the very black comedy, the very dark stuff. Yeah. Whereas it was obvious he was meant to be
the light relief,
especially in something like The Apocalypse War, where he spends the entire time with this fake Italian landlady slung over his shoulder as she's threatening to kill him, and there's all these horrible things happening.
They were some of our best scenes.
No, it's weird, because I don't often think of Walter when I think back to Dredd, you know what I mean? And I don't know if I've just subconsciously filtered him out.
I saw him as part of the Mickey take, the R2-D2 cute droid kind of...
Oh, right, okay.
You know, rib poke thing. But it was in the, you see, we were being absolutely faithful, so we just had to do it.
It's weird, though, isn't it, with Dredd? Because even when you talk about now, you got, especially in the 80s, with what was going on within the country, and feeling like at times, you know, with the miners strike and stuff, that we were almost in this civil war, to be such a fan of what was almost, you could argue, was what Thatcher was working towards. You know what I mean? I don't know if I'm making Dredd American.
It
distanced you a little bit. You know what I mean? That it was the elusive system over there, that you're going, that your favourite comic book hero would be this... absolutist, you know, enforcer of the law, and yet when you're turning on the TV, you're going, God, it looks like the country's
because when it started, you had both sides of the coin, because you had Dredd, which is the extreme satire, but then you also had Invasion with Bill Savage, where Britain gets invaded by the Volgans, those are Russians, and you know, you've got somebody who looks an awful lot like Margaret Thatcher being executed on the steps of St Paul's, and you know, one of those strips, I mean, Savage has been revived by Pat Mills, and it's going from strength to strength, but it's still a very overtly political strip, and Pat uses it as such, whereas Dredd was the more versatile character because the potential was so massive. And I guess it's one of the great things about radio is that you don't need a massive budget to make something like Mega City 1 come alive. You know, you need the sound of traffic,
massive budget. You don't need it.
Before is perfect, though, that you still have those pictures in your mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's an awful ask. I think whenever you are putting images to something or creating that world, you know what I mean? The wall that you come up against. Lord of the Rings, I didn't have a problem with it, apart from the fact that I should have been Sam Gamgee. Yeah. I wasn't so bad in front of a green screen. Giant spider, shoo. but then I saw where the elves lived, you know, and you go, oh, it's a bit Centre Parks. And I was in the cinema and I thought, did that come out loud? Did I think that? I'll just say it.
You know, millions of pounds. No, it was more Longleat than Elf.
Yeah.
Mini golf is good, though.
Yeah. But with this, you do have, you know, you've got the images.
Yeah.
Certain images burn.
Well, you do. And then I do remember Mega City 1, you're right, what's it sound like? Yeah, and it is fun to build those layers up. You know, well, there's going to be things scooting about at sky level and ground level and there's this and there's that. And the in-jokes we got in, you know, there was stuff about, you know, like people with belly wheels, you know, which really was totally subliminal, but you heard sort of heavy footsteps and a little squeaky wheel going on and so on. And it's because you have, it was rich. I mean, I get what Johnny's saying about, you know, really dread is the nightmare we all try and avoid. And you're right. But I think that's the endearing thing about it, dread. It doesn't say it isn't going to be awful, but it sort of somehow subverts it into being funny.
But it's very telling that I was never DC or Marvel comics. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think I'll get strung up for this, but what, the people that seem to, you know what I mean? These characters to me that were just out and out heroes.
Yeah.
That didn't have enough flaws. Now, I'm sure if I'd read those, you got, no, there's layers of that, but you're going, it was the anti-hero of Dread.
Yeah.
That appealed to me, and I never wanted anything just as black and white and straightforward as that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think from an early age, that touched on something that you don't even notice is almost developing in yourself. I think it's this moral question of...
I think it's a very interesting point, because I think it's a kind of a backlash. It's the same as punk. It all happens the same as punk rock happens. So, and arguably, your way you develop your comedy, your act, if you like, was from the dark end of things. It was that thing of you know, fighting out from under something. And I think that's very interesting. I think it changed. I'm definitely of the old Kurt Swan Superman era, you know, or the wonderfully named artist Wayne Boring, who actually probably drew the most boring, rather stout Superman of the late 50s. But I was from that era, and I am always the happy ending guy. Mm. And it always makes me laugh, because Johnny and I work together on a lot of things, you know, and I kind of go in like Pollyanna. It's something where people are stringing themselves up left, right and centre. So it's kind of, it is, I think a change happened, and it's very interesting. Mm. But it's still got such a huge following. People love it so much. Mm. And love it, and I think they love it for a better reason than, dare I say, things like Doctor Who. Because I think, in a way, with 2000 AD, it's a whole culture. And all the artists, Dave Gibbons, Brian Hitch, who else? You know, look at Pat writing, and Alan writing, and all of this stuff. All of that talent that the Americans hoovered up in the 80s, because this stuff really was different. And it's such a fantastic legacy.
Well, it's something that I, when I sort of give talks and everything about 2000 AD, I say, you know, if you look at the state of comic books now, with things like Image Comics and a lot of the, you know, the darker stuff with Vertigo and whatnot, a lot of these comics wouldn't exist without 2000 AD, because the Americans would never been exposed to that kind of black humour. Yeah. You know, if they'd met these talents, they would have tried to change them rather than try and harness the kind of stuff they were doing on Dread and you know, on 2000 AD in general. So, I mean, goodness sake, Alan Moore, Grant Morrison, Mark Miller, you know, the biggest names in comic books, and they all got their start at 2000 AD. You can't ignore that legacy. Yeah.
No, not at all. And I don't think, I don't think I would have got to do Superman originally if it wasn't for that, because when I rang DC, it was another English person.
Right.
I mean, I was at the BBC, that helped. but you know, the fact was that we were hot. Mm. And this was the time of...
And there is something with me that there is that thing of taking on the big boys.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And going, but just doing it, that little bit of style, that little bit more... Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's the same almost with stand-up. I remember going to Montreal, and it was the way the Americans approached the stand-up.
Mm.
Compared to the, you know, the British camp, and it was genuinely like an urgent smacking this act. He was slapping him in the face and going, why are we here? Why are we working for? What the? And they knew every turn, every, you know, they were so polished what camera they were going to look into, what the. My manager at the time went, would you like me to hit you? And I went, do you want to try? Do you want to see how that ends? And they were so like, they could trim their act by 15 seconds to get on Letterman, you know what I mean? Yeah, there was that camp, and then in our camp, you had Alan Davis going, I might talk about budgies. And yet, creatively.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The freewheeling sort of, the freedom that the English comics had. And I think it's, you know what I mean, very much bears comparison to that freedom that all these artists coming up and working through 2000 AD, where you're going, do you know what I mean? There wasn't anything burning down on them. It's like, we can take them on and we can do this with a bit of class.
Yeah.
And it's something that just lifts it above, and you know what I mean? That's why I feel like when I grew up reading that, there was this golden age of, it doesn't get much better than what was in those
those pages. Grit is the oyster thing, isn't it? Well, they're technically fantastic. Technically brilliant. I mean, they still are.
Yeah.
I was just looking at some of your latest stuff on the iPad, and the quality of the art is just to die for. I mean, it's beautiful. There is such vision and so on. I'm sort of, you know, slightly, how should we say, you know, dazed at how good it still is. Forgive me, I haven't, you know, it's hard to keep up with everything.
No, absolutely.
I've missed it for a bit, but wow.
Yeah. But in many ways, the transition from UK industry to America continues. Not that we're bitter or jealous of anything about it, because we obviously want to see all our creators do very well for themselves. But you know, there's still very much this sense of, well, who's the latest talent coming from Britain? Because they're going to make a difference. So you get somebody like Al Ewing, who's been writing Dread for a few years. He did a comedy series called Zombo for 2018, which is absolutely bloody hilarious, considering that Russell Brand gets killed within like the first two episodes. You know, he's now doing Avengers and Loki and everything for Marvel, and bringing very much that sensibility from 2000 AD over to his work. And it's just great to see that, you know, they kind of accept that's the deal when they're getting a Brit into something.
It's almost an ongoing thing, though, isn't it? It's across so many different fields that we breed the most creative and the most, you know what I mean, ingenuity, everything. And then it's this thing of they come in and cherry pick. Not always with the best, you know what I mean? That it's a shame there's not enough to keep hold some of the talent.
On the other hand, it does force us. I say us. I mean, you know, but in the comedy business, one of the things I always was really proudest of working at Light End was bring your writers, who then had fantastic careers. You know, and I gave first commission to Debbie Burrow. I gave first commission to so on and so forth. You know, and it was really, really a sense of achievement. And the thing is, you're finding new talent and bringing it on is part of the best of the business. And yeah, okay. I notice, you know, that there's talk about, you know, writers sort of getting to work in parallel with other writers on projects, and only one of them gets picked, you know, over in the States at certain corporations we can't talk about. And you think to yourself, but that doesn't happen here, because if 2000 AD, for example, takes a punt on someone, it genuinely will give them a chance to come through, and it will recognise them for doing it. You know, so in a way, if those guys want to take I was going to say the king's shilling, the president's dollar, that's great. But you know, that's a kind of, you know, that's not necessarily the idyllic world that they're trying to get to. And yeah, it's horrible to lose them, but then of course there's space for someone else to come through.
But Johnny, you've been picking up the Judge Dredd Mega Collection, the hardback books.
Yeah.
What's that been like? Sort of getting to grips with all the classics.
Brilliant. Because I from a certain period, you know, I had that. I loved the, you know, the weekly thing of going, down to the newsagents and your copy being waiting for you and getting home and reading it. And then between, again, going away to seminary and one thing or another, you know, feeling like I got to the point where you were dipping in and out and it was misfits to sort of sit and read a complete, like, America.
Yeah.
That was just a phenomenal piece of storytelling. Do you know what I mean? So now, it's great to have it. I always feel like I'm gutted because, you know, there's a story in my book about how I sold my collection when I was younger and never forgave myself.
Yeah, what did you say to me earlier? You
I sold it for £3.50 to get cider.
I thought he said he sold it for £3.50. No. I thought, well, that's not so bad.
And I had
there's a decimal point in between the three and the five.
Well, the earliest I got, because I didn't have the money, but I'd a jumble sale. I'd got a 2000 AD number four,
right,
which was my pride and joy, and amongst, you know what I mean, my own collection.
Yeah.
And just a moment of madness. I sold it to this, like, Andy Cave, if you're listening. I sold it to him and then regretted it 2 days later, and he wouldn't sell it back to me. And he wouldn't. In fact, recently, that's when I was promoting the book, Frank Cottrell Boyce knows him and tried to get in touch and tried to buy it back for me as a surprise, because my mate's dad brought us to London for the signing, which was something that my, you know what I mean, it would never happen within my family. So it was just this. I remember a lad at the time, a couple of years ago, had offered me £30 for it, and I wouldn't part with it for love and the money. And it was just within that, like, that year later. But I always feel like I just wish I'd hold on to them. And there's, I suppose a few years ago, I bet me would have felt guilty going, well, you're buying them now when you should have owned them the first time around. But sod that. For me now, like I say, it's more going back and revisiting and fleshing out the bits that we're missing.
And also,
even the graphic style, do you know what I mean? The different artists coming in. It's incredible how you look at from one artist to another and you go, oh God, that was a period that I loved it. It could be quite an odd thing when a new artist came in. If you weren't... Do you know what I mean? If you weren't as taken...
Well, in those very early days, something like The Cursed Earth has 3-4 artists on it, you know, and that was just the way of things because, you know, the script needed to be finished. Yeah. Whereas these days, we, as much as possible, we try and keep the same artists on things.
But, I go back to it. I have to do it retrospectively because I didn't do it like you did it. And to me, it's like... It's the modern equivalent of, this is not a good analogy, but Wind of the Willows or one of the... I mean, it's become something that's uniquely British.
Mm.
It's part of our cultural identity now, and it will remain so. And it's, so you can revisit it at any point in your life. It's if you appreciate good work, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
There's that little thing of going, when you're all grown up and it, it's that classic thing of bills and stuff coming through the door. It is brilliant to get something in the post that actually delights you. You only go, this only happens on birthdays normally.
Yeah.
You know, to open something.
It's a bit of a licit treat, isn't it? Yeah,
it is. And they're the kind of things that I don't... There's no conference with my wife. I just order them. I just get them. Well, there's no. It's being processed. I'm not sending a cheque. She'll cancel it. Put it on the card and do it now.
Yeah, buy with one click. Yeah.
No, but it's an amazing collection. You know what I mean? It's there's no messing about. Like I said, it's got none. It's something working away from home. You know that you come back and you go, right, there's another two to take with. There's another, it travels with me now. And that's what it used to be. And funny enough, I've started carrying a sketchbook again.
Oh wow.
You know what I mean? And it is, one does
great,
I'm sure, inspire the other in me. And you're going, again, this is something that when did I stop sketching? When did I, you know, I'd had these ideas for my own strips for years, and then it just faded off and you go, come back now and find myself doodling, you know, in the meetings that you're not grabbed in.
Yeah.
It's all that thing where you can trail off, you can pick up on where you're completely lost interest.
That head is a bit like a bunch of bananas.
We see you in a studio, family environment, whatever, all right. suddenly there's a miniature Dread helmet in the bottom left hand corner. Yeah. You know, you've lost me.
Yeah. Yeah, your cross hatching skills.
Yeah.
That's interesting you say about the kind of the weekly thrill of having been to the newsagent, because the vast majority of our readers still buy us from newsagents. They still go to their newsagents and pick us off the shelf and they buy us that
That's
way.
Great.
Yeah.
That is
great. And we I mean, we're the last of the great sci-fi comics, one of the last great comics from the golden age of the 70s and 80s. And for the vast majority of our readers to still be newsstand purchasers, it's part of the DNA of 2008.
Well, I go to Reagan in Richmond now.
All right.
And I get my comic. You know what I mean? I get my 2008 every week now. Oh, and that's my little thrill. It's got, you know what I mean? Yeah, collecting them. Yeah. And it's weird being away from them and then going in and getting a bunch back to back. You know, and going...
Yeah.
And with my son as well, I just want him to have that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. That same thrill of this.
And he's into
this, I think it's bizarre now because, as well, it's a very different upbringing that it was an investment to buy something. You were invested in it. We didn't have very little, you know what I mean? Kind of probably doesn't want for the things that we wanted for. I was thinking the other day, in mourning about going clothes shopping, you know, and you're going, we got clothes for Christmas. I don't want to turn this into... So whatever I invested in buying my 2000 AD every week, it was something that felt, you know what I mean?
Well, that was your entertainment for the week,
and
wasn't it?
Yeah. And for me now, I want him to have that, just that same thing of going, like, so we go together once a week, but you just go, for me, I think I'm more thrilled than he is for that.
But it's great that you can't, you know, it's a shop you can't take, you know, I remember, you know, Forbidden Planet, for whatever our local in Southampton, taking my boys in. You know, and it was a treat for all of us in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, everybody headed for a different particular department. Mm. But it was something that we could do. That it was a little bit of bonding for father and sons, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a few months ago, and I'm sure I tweeted it, but it was just amazing. He'd, because he was with me for the week, so with his mum for the week, and while I was with his mum for the week, he went, I saw this and I thought you'd like it. And it was a 2000 AD.
Oh, wow.
Judge Dredd comment. And you only think that it's in his head that he's been in a supermarket, that he's parted with his own money.
Yeah.
Because he's always laughing at me. If we go in toy shops, I'm buying more than him. There's the shame, you know, the shame element. I think we're just, how many minifigures have you got there? And suddenly it's role reversal. I'm going, 10. 10, but I really want the hot dog man, and it's none of your business. Just leave
my money, I can spend how I want. Yeah.
But I was, honest to God, I was so touched by the fact that he thought of this and bought me that. You know what I mean? And he goes, he gets me.
Yeah.
Gets me, my lad. That was.
Yeah. Yeah, scary when they know you.
But there's so much stuff to catch up on. The nice thing is, at the minute, I was just so early, you've got the trucking.
Yes.
Out again, which I loved. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's one that doesn't get enough mentions for me.
And it was one of the best sort of overall concepts. It was such a great, neat idea. Yeah.
But it wasn't just the setting, it wasn't just the characters, it was the language.
Yeah.
And that's what John Wagner and Alan Grant do so wonderfully, is language.
Yes, yes.
You know, and the fact that they, with the first episodes, they had to publish a dictionary so you knew what, you know, but after what, it's that kind of Clockwork Orange thing that eventually, even if you've not got the dictionary, you can work out what people are saying, you get a sense of the world and how they're interacting. And
you do. Well, exactly the same. Because what you do is, once it had all dropped in, you can go back and read it again.
Yeah.
At a different sort of pace, you know, without the your brain's just automatically translating. Where you go through to,
because you get the stuff you didn't pick up the first time.
Yeah.
That's what I always try to do with the radio things, was always put more in, like the belly wheel idea.
Yeah.
You didn't hear it on the first listen. Well, the second listen, if you paid attention to the background announcement, then you'd hear it.
Yeah. Well, we had Emma Beebe on just recently. She's one of our newer writers.
Yeah.
And she did part of her kind of writing apprenticeship on radio stuff, and she was saying that one of the things that she always found quite restrictive about writing for radio was you've constantly got to remind people where the characters are, what they're doing. Because she did Doctor Who audio dramas with her writing partner, Gordon Rennie. Yeah. And it's also, you know, well, this must be a very good grounding for comics because, you know, it's all about dialogue, it's all about character. And she was like, well... It can be really restrictive about what you can do because you've constantly got to be poking people and reminding them.
You've got to find very creative ways to do that without appearing to do it.
Yeah. But so much material in something like Mega City One, just as you say, for this tiny little belly wheel sound as someone's walking along.
Yeah, you can lose it. And that is where I think it's a good... there's a good sort of, what's the word, you know, it's like the we coexist very, very well, sound and vision, your vision, ourselves.
Yeah.
And if you get it right, anyone who listens who doesn't know the comics should still be able to get a really rich experience. But it helps if you do.
I never got silly about my, you know, I actually got a cricket club and painted it green once. Inspired by Dread. Yeah. Because there was another school that I had to walk past on the way to school. I suddenly thought that would give me a harder punch. The punch of Dread. That ended badly.
Well, we've already heard Dirk's version of Dread. Ironically doing an impression of the actor that you had doing the voice of Dread.
Gary Morrison.
Yeah.
The
But, Johnny, give us your best Dread.
The best Dread. Okay, well, nice hair. Too much pressure. Scottish again, man. I am the law.
Do you know what? You got a little bit bigger as you said that.
I did. Did I? I always saw myself more as a Johnny Alpha.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Good.
Not in the looks, but in the voice. I think I could.
Well, he's from Milton Keynes, so you know.
It killed me because it got to that age where he got too old. But am I the only person who ever thought if there would had there been a big screen adaptation? Because we always had this argument. Clint Eastwood for Johnny Alpha.
Oh, normally I hear Clint Eastwood in his prime for Dread.
I've not heard about him.
Well,
that was always my
He's
still available.
Bit creaky now.
but he had the eyes for it, and
I always thought he was a bit scrawny for Alpha.
He was around the jaw, but it was just the upper.
Okay.
I can't think. Who'd you choose for Alpha?
Oh,
I know who I'd choose now. Your man from The Wire, English actor.
Dominic West.
Good choice. Do let us know if there's a star casting you'd like to see in a 2080 film adaptation. Just email thrillcast, all one word, at 2080online.com.
I had one of them dreams I'm not allowed to have now because I'm married. Watch Charlize Theron playing Halo.
Oh, right.
Do you not think Charlize Theron? Is she too? Maybe a bit old.
I can see that.
Oh.
Well, the thing is that Halo's meant to be a teenager when she starts.
Yeah, no, I know, that's what I mean. She's too old now. But there's just a certain... She's got the lip line.
A bit polished, maybe.
Yeah, but we could...
You could scruff her
up
a bit.
Sounds wrong going, you could rough her up. Not rough her up, scruff her up a bit.
If you're listening, Ms. Theron, we're...
We're not that's serious. Not what it means. That was very much right there. No, that's great. Well, I think that's all we've got time for. So I want to say a really special thank you to you both for coming in and being on the Thrillcast. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
Hopefully we'll be
back.
We'll be back.
It's been a thrill for us. Thank you for having us.
It's super. Pleasure.
I'm actually in the nerve centre.
Like 2 10-year-olds losing a sweet shot we've been.
Yeah.
Great. Absolutely fantastic. What an absolutely thrill-packed episode of the 2080 Thrillcast this week. Thank you so much to Gordon and to Johnny and to Dirk for being our guests for this week. And thank you to all of you
for listening. The feedback, as I said previously, has been absolutely fantastic. Please do let us know what you think, what you'd like to hear, stories you'd like us to focus on, graphic novels, characters, creators, whatever you'd like to hear, please do let us know about it. We are on ThrillMail, all one word, at 2000adonline.com, or we are on Twitter at 2000ad. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Remember, Earthlets, don't be a Grexnix, Splundig Verthrig!